This door is solid oak, 2 inches thick.
What about that one?
Cuthbert pointed toward the rear of the office. That goes into the Hall of Cretaceous Dinosaurs. It's just like this one, solid oak. He tucked the Ruger into his belt. Those fools going into the basement like so many lemmings. They should have listened to me. He rummaged in the file drawer again and pulled out a flashlight.
Excellent. Haven't used this in years.
He snapped it on and a feeble beam shot out, wavering as his hand shook a little.
Not much juice left in that torch, I'd say,
Cuthbert murmured. Wright turned it off. We'll only use it in an emergency.
Please, Rickman spoke suddenly. Please leave it on, just for a minute.
She was sitting on a stool in the center of the room, clenching and unclenching her hands.
Henry, what are we going to do? We must have a plan.
First things first, said Wright. I need a drink, that's plan A. My nerves are shot.
He made his way to the far side of the lab and shone the light in an old cabinet, finally pulling out a bottle. There was a clink of glass.
Ian?
Asked Wright.
Nothing for me,
Cuthbert replied.
Lavinia?
No, I couldn't.
Wright came back and sat down at a work table. He filled the tumbler and drank it off in 3 gulps. Then he refilled it. Suddenly the room was full of the warm, peaty scent of single malt scotch.
Easy there, Winston, said Cuthbert.
We can't stay here in the dark, Rickman said nervously. There must be an exit somewhere on this floor.
I'm telling you, everything's sealed off, Wright snapped.
What about the dinosaur hall?
Said Rickman, pointing to the rear door.
Lavinia, said Wright, the dinosaur hall has only one public entrance, and that's been sealed by a security door. We're completely locked in. But you don't need to worry, because whatever killed Ippolito and the others won't be after us. It'll go after the easy kill, the group blundering around in the basement.
There was a swallowing sound, then the loud smack of glass hitting the table.
I say we stay here for another half hour, wait it out. Then we'll go back down into the exhibition. If they haven't restored power and unsealed the doors by then, I know of another way out. Through the exhibition.
You seem to know all kinds of hiding places, Cuthbert said.
This used to be my lab. Once in a while, I still like to come down here, get away from the administrative headaches, be near my dinosaurs again.
He chuckled and drank.
I'll see, said Cuthbert acidly.
Part of the superstition exhibition is mounted in what used to be the old trilobite alcove. I put in a lot of hours down there many years ago. Anyway, there was a passageway to the Broadway corridor behind one of the old trilobite displays. The door was boarded up years ago to make room for another display case. I'm sure that when they were building superstition, they just nailed a piece of plywood over it and painted it. We could kick it in, shoot off the lock with this if necessary.
That sounds feasible, said Rickman eagerly.
I don't recall hearing about any such door in the exhibition, Cuthbert said dubiously. I'm sure security would have known about it.
It was years ago, I tell you,
Wright snapped. It was boarded over and forgotten. There was a long silence while Wright poured another drink.
Winston, Cuthbert said, put that drink down.
The director took a long swig, then hung his head. His shoulders slumped.
Ian, he murmured finally. How could this have happened? We're ruined, you know.
Cuthbert was silent.
Let's not bury the patient before the diagnosis, said Rickman in a desperately bright voice. Good public relations can repair even the worst damage.
Lavinia, we aren't talking about a few poisoned headache tablets here, Cuthbert said. There's half a dozen dead people, maybe more, lying 2 floors below us. The bloody mayor is trapped down there. In a couple of hours we'll be on every late news show in the country.
We're ruined, Wright repeated.
A small, strangled sob escaped from his throat, and he laid his head down on the table.
Bloody hell,
muttered Cuthbert, reaching over for Wright's bottle and glass and putting them back in the cabinet.
It's over, isn't it?
Wright moaned without raising his head.
Yes, Winston, it's over, said Cuthbert. Frankly, I'll be happy just to get out of here with my life.
Please, Ian, let's leave here, please, Rickman pleaded.
She stood up and walked over to the door Wright had closed behind them and swung it open slowly.
This wasn't locked, she said sharply.
Good Lord, Cuthbert said, jumping up.
Wright, without lifting his head, fished in his pocket and held out a key.
Fits both doors, he said in a muffled voice.
Rickman's shaking hand rattled the key loudly in the lock.
What did we do wrong? Wright asked plaintively. That's clear enough, said Cuthbert. 5 years ago we had a chance to solve this thing.
What do you mean?
Asked Rickman, coming back toward them.
You know very well what. I'm talking about Montague's disappearance. We should have taken care of the problem then instead of pretending it never happened. All that blood in the basement near the Whittlesey crates, Montague gone missing. In hindsight, we now know exactly what happened to him. But we should have gotten to the bottom of it then. You remember, Winston, we were sitting in your office when Ippolito came in with the news. He ordered the floor cleaned and the incident forgotten. We washed our hands of it and hoped whoever or whatever killed Montague would disappear.
There was no proof anyone was killed, Wright wailed, lifting his head, and certainly no proof it was Montague. It could have been a stray dog or something. How could we have known?
We didn't know. But we might have found out had you allowed Ippolito to report that monstrous great bloodstain to the police. And you, Lavinia, as I recall, you agreed that we should simply wash that blood away.
Ian, there was no sense in creating a needless scandal. You know very well that blood could have been from anything, Rickman said. And Ian, it was you who insisted those crates be moved. You who worried the exhibition would raise questions about the Whittlesey expedition. You who took the journal and then asked me to keep it for you until the exhibition was over. The journal didn't fit in with your theories, did it?
Cuthbert snorted.
How little you know. Julian Whittlesey was my friend. At least he was once. We had a falling out over an article he published, and we never patched things up. Anyway, it's rather too late for that now. But I didn't want to see that journal come to light, his theories held up for ridicule.
He turned and stared at the public relations director.
What I did, Lavinia, was simply try to protect the colleague who'd gone a bit barmy. I didn't cover up a killing. And what about the sightings? Winston, you received several reports a year about people seeing or hearing strange things after hours. You never once did anything about it, did you?
How could I have known? Came the spluttering response. Who'd have believed it? They were crank reports, ridiculous.
Can we change the subject, please? Cried Rickman. I can't wait here in the dark. Maybe the windows. Perhaps they'll spread a net for us.
No, said Wright, sighing deeply and rubbing his eyes.
Those bars are case-hardened steel, several inches thick. He peered around the darkened room. Where's my drink?
You've had enough, said Cuthbert.
You and your damned Anglican moralizing. He lurched to his feet and headed for the cabinet with a slightly unsteady gait. In the stairwell, D'Agosta looked toward the dim figure of Bailey.
Thanks, he said. You're in charge, Lou.
Below them, the large group of guests was waiting, huddled together on the steps, sniffling and sobbing. D'Agosta turned to face them.
Okay, he said quietly. We've got to move fast. The next landing down has a door leading into the basement. We're going to go through it and meet up with some others who know a way out of here. Everybody understand?
We understand,
came a voice that D'Agosta recognized as the mayor's.
Good, D'Agosta nodded. Okay, let's go. I'll get to the front and lead the way with my light. Bailey, you cover our rear. Let me know if you see anything.
Slowly the group descended. On the landing, D'Agosta waited until Bailey gave him the all-clear sign. Then he grabbed the door handle. It didn't budge. D'Agosta gave it another yank. Harder this time. No luck.
What the...
He brought his flashlight to bear on the handle.
Shit,
he muttered. Then, in a louder tone, he said,
Everybody stay where you are for a moment. Be as quiet as possible. I'm going up to talk to my officer at the rear.
He retraced his steps.
Listen, Bailey,
he told him softly.
We can't get into the basement.
Some of our slugs ripped into the door, and they've bent the jamb all to hell. There's no way we can get the thing open without a crowbar.
Even in the dark, you could see Bailey's eyes widen.
So what are we going to do? The sergeant asked. Go back upstairs?
Let me think a minute, the Gusta said. How much ammo do you have? I've got 6 rounds of my service piece.
I don't know, 15, 16 rounds maybe.
Damn, the Gusta said.
He stopped, abruptly shutting off his flashlight and listening to the close darkness. A slight movement of air down the stairwell brought a ripe, goatish smell. Bailey dropped to one knee, aiming the shotgun up the staircase. DeGusta quickly turned to the group waiting below him.
Everybody, he hissed, down to the next landing, quick.
There was a series of low murmurs.
We can't go down there, somebody cried. We'll be trapped underground.
DeGusta's response was drowned by the blast of Bailey's shotgun.
The museum beast! Somebody screamed, and the group turned, stumbling and falling down the stairs.
Bailey!
DeGusta shouted, his ears ringing from the blast.
Bailey, follow me!
Walking backward down the stairs, one hand holding his handgun, the other feeling its way against the wall, DeGusta noticed the surface of the stairwell turn to damp stone as he moved below the level of the basement. Farther up the stairwell, he could see the dim form of Bailey following, gasping and cursing under his breath. After what seemed an eternity, DeGusta's foot hit the sub-basement landing. All around him, people held their breaths. Then Bailey bumped into him gently.
Bailey, what the fuck was it?
He whispered.
I don't know, came the response. There was that horrible smell. Then I thought I saw something. 2 red eyes in the dark. I fired.
DeGusta shone his flashlight up the stairwell. The light showed only shadows and rough-hewn yellow rock, crudely carved. The smell lingered. He shone the flashlight toward the group and did a quick head count. 38, including himself and Bailey.
Okay, he whispered to the group. We're in the sub-basement. I'm gonna go in first, then you follow at my signal.
He turned and shined his light over the door.
Christ, he thought. This thing belongs in the Tower of London.
The blackened metal door was reinforced with horizontal strips of iron. When he pushed it open, cool, damp, moldy air rushed into the stairwell. DeGusta started forward. At the sound of gurgling water, he stepped back, then played the light downward.
Listen, everybody. There's running water down here, about 3 inches deep. Come forward one at a time, quickly but carefully. There are 2 steps down on the far side of the door. Bailey, take up the rear. And for God's sake, close the door behind you.
Pendergast counted the remaining bullets, pocketed them, then looked in Frock's direction.
Truly fascinating. And a clever bit of detection work on your part. I'm sorry I doubted you, Professor.
Frock gestured magnanimously.
How are you to know? Besides, it was Margot here who discovered the most important link. If she hadn't tested those packing fibers, we never would have known.
Pendergast nodded at Margot, huddled on top of a large wooden crate.
Brilliant work. We could use you in the Baton Rouge crime lab.
Assuming I let her go. And assuming we get out of here alive. Dubious assumptions at best.
And assuming I'm willing to leave the museum, Margot said, surprising even herself.
Pendergast turned to Margot.
I know you understand this creature better than I do. Still, do you truly believe this plan you've described will work?
Margot took a deep breath, nodded.
If the extrapolator is correct, this beast hunts by smell rather than sight. And if its need for the plant is as strong as we think it is, it's the only way.
Pendergast remained motionless a moment.
If it will save those people below us, we have to try.
He pulled out his radio and adjusted the channel.
DeGusta. DeGusta, this is Pendergast. Do you read?
DeGusta here.
DeGusta, what's your status?
We met up with that creature of yours. It got into the hall, killed Ippolito and an injured guest. We moved into the stairwell, but the basement door was jammed. We had to go to the sub-basement.
Understood.
How many of your weapons were you able to take?
We only had time to grab 1 12-gauge and a service revolver.
What's your current position?
In the sub-basement, maybe 50 yards from the stairwell door.
Listen closely, Vincent. I've been speaking with Professor Frock. The creature we're dealing with is extremely intelligent. Maybe even as smart as you or I.
Speak for yourself.
If you see it again, don't aim for the head. The slugs will just bounce off the skull. Aim for the body.
There was silence for a moment. Then Augusta's voice returned.
Look, Pendergast, you need to tell Coffee some of this. He's sending some men in, and I don't think he has any idea of what's waiting for him.
I'll do my best. But first, let's talk about getting you out of here. That beast may be hunting you.
No shit.
I can direct you out of the museum through the sub-basement. It won't be easy. These blueprints are very old, and they may not be completely reliable. There may be water.
We're standing in a half a foot of it now. Look, Pendergast, are you sure about this? I mean, there's a mother of a storm outside.
It's either face the water or face the beast. There are 40 of you. You're the most obvious target. You've got to move, and move quickly. It's the only way out.
Can you link up with us?
No. We've decided to stay here and lure it away from you. There's no time to explain now. If our plan works, we'll join you further on. Thanks to these blueprints, I've discovered more than one way to get into the sub-basement from Cell 2.
Christ, Pendergast, be careful.
I intend to. Now listen carefully. Are you in a long, straight passage?
Yes.
Very good. Where the hall forks, go right. The hall should fork a second time in another 100 yards or so. When you get to the second fork, radio me. Got it?
Got it.
Good luck. Pendergast out.
Pendergast quickly switched frequencies.
Coffee, this is Pendergast. Do you copy?
Coffee here. God damn it, Pendergast, I've been trying to reach you for...
No time for that now. Are you sending a rescue team in?
Yes, they're preparing to leave now.
Then make sure they're armed with heavy caliber automatic weapons, flak helmets, and bulletproof vests. There's a powerful, murderous creature in here, Coffee. I saw it. It has the run of Cell 2.
For Christ's sakes, you and Augusta? Pendergast, if you're trying to...
Pendergast spoke rapidly into the radio.
I'll only warn you once more. You're dealing with something monstrous here. Underestimated at your peril. I'm signing off.
No, Pendergast, wait. I order you to...
Pendergast switched off the radio. 52. They slogged into the water, dim flashlight beams licking the low ceilings in front and behind. The flow of air in the tunnel continued to blow gently into their faces. Augusta was alarmed now. The beast could come up behind them unannounced, its stench wafted away from them. He paused a moment to let Bailey catch up. Catching his breath, the mayor said,
Lieutenant, are you certain there's a way out through here?
I can only go by what Agent Pendergast said, sir. He's got the blueprints. But I sure as hell know we don't want to go back.
Augusta and the group started forward again. Dark, oily drops were falling from a ceiling of arched herringbone bricks. The walls were crusted with lime. Everyone was silent except for one woman who was quietly weeping.
Excuse me, Lieutenant,
said a voice. The young, lanky guy, Smithback.
Yes?
Would you mind telling me something?
Shoot.
How does it feel to have the lives of 40 people, including the mayor of New York City, in your hands?
What?
Augusta stopped a moment, glared over his shoulder.
Don't tell me we've got a fucking journalist with us.
Well, I... Call downtown and make an appointment to see me at headquarters.
DeGusta played the light ahead and found the fork in the tunnel. He took the right-hand passage, as Pendergast had directed. It had a slight downhill grade, and the water began to move faster, tugging on his pants legs as it rushed past into the blackness beyond. The wound in his hand throbbed. As the group moved around the corner behind him, DeGusta noted with relief that the breeze was no longer blowing in their faces. A bloated dead rat came floating past, bumping against people's legs like a lazy, oversized billiard ball. One person groaned and tried to kick it away, but no one complained.
"Bailey,"
called DeGusta behind him.
"Yeah? See anything?"
"You'll be the first to know if I do."
"Gotcha. I'm going to call in upstairs, see if they've made any progress in restoring power."
He grabbed his radio.
"Coffee?"
"Reading. Pendergast just shut me off. Where are you?"
"We're in the sub-basement. Pendergast has a blueprint. He's leading us out by radio. When are the lights coming on?"
"DeGusta, don't be an idiot. He'll get you all killed. It doesn't look as if we'll be getting power back on anytime soon. Go back to the Hall of the Heavens and wait there. We'll be sending the SWAT team in through the roof in a couple of minutes."
"Then you should know that Wright, Cuthbert, and the public relations director are upstairs somewhere, the fourth floor probably. That's the only other exit point for that stairwell."
"What are you talking about? You didn't take them with you?"
"They refused to come along. Wright got out on his own and the others followed him."
"Sounds like they had more sense than you did. Is the mayor all right? Let me talk to him."
DeGusta handed the radio over.
"Are you all right, sir?"
"We're in capable hands with the lieutenant."
"It's my strong opinion, sir, that you should head back to the Hall of the Heavens and wait there for assistance. We're sending in a SWAT team to rescue you."
"I have every confidence in Lieutenant DeGusta, as should you."
"Yes, of course, sir. Rest assured that I'm going to get you safely out of there, sir."
"Coffee?"
"Sir?"
"There are 36 people in here besides me. Don't forget that."
"But I just want you to know, sir, we're being extra..."
"Coffee, I don't think you understood me. Every life down here is worth all the effort you've got."
"Yes, sir."
The mayor handed the radio back to DeGusta. "Am I wrong, or is that fellow Coffee a horse's ass?" DeGusta holstered the radio and proceeded down the passage. Then he stopped, playing his flashlight over an object that loomed out of the blackness in front of them. It was a steel door. Closed. The oily water rushed through a thickly barred grating in its bottom panel. He waded closer. It was similar to the door at the base of the stairwell, thick, double-plated, studded with rusty rivets. An old copper lock covered with verdigris was looped through a thick metal D-ring along the door's side. DeGusta grabbed the lock and pulled, but it held fast.
"Pendergast,"
said DeGusta, removing his radio once again.
"Reading."
"We're past the first fork, but we've hit a steel door and it's locked."
"A locked door? Between the first and second forks?"
"Yes."
"And you took a right at the first fork?"
"Yes."
"1 minute."
There was a shuffling sound.
"Vincent, go back to the fork and take the left-hand tunnel. Hurry."
"Bailey, we're heading back to that last fork. All of you, let's go, on the double."
The group turned wearily, murmuring, and started moving back through the inky water.
"Wait!"
came the voice of Bailey from the head of the group.
"Christ, Lieutenant, do you smell it?"
"No,"
said DeGusta. Then,
"Shit!"
as the fetid stench enveloped him.
"Bailey, we're gonna have to make a stand. I'm coming up. Fire at the son of a bitch!"
Cuthbert sat on the work table, absently tapping its scarred surface with a pencil eraser. At the far end of the table, Wright sat motionless, his head in his hands. Rickman stood on her tiptoes by the small window. She was angling the flashlight through the bars in front of the glass, switching it on and off with a manicured finger. A brief flash of lightning silhouetted her thin form, then a low rumble of thunder filled the room. "It's pouring out," she said. "I can't see a thing."
"And nobody can see you," said Cuthbert wearily. "All you're doing is wearing out the battery. We may need it later."
With an audible sigh, Rickman switched off the light, plunging the lab once again into darkness.
"I wonder what it did with Montague's body," came the slurred voice of Wright. "Ate him up?"
Laughter spluttered out of the gloom.
"Where's my whiskey, Ian, you damn Scotsman? Where'd you hide my whiskey?"
Cuthbert continued tapping the pencil.
"Ate him up. With a little curry and rice, maybe. Montague pilaf,"
Wright chuckled. Cuthbert stood up, reached over toward the director, and plucked the .38 from Wright's belt. He checked the bullets, then tucked it into his own belt.
"Return that at once," Wright demanded.
Cuthbert said nothing.
"You're a bully, Ian. You've always been a bully, a small-minded, jealous bully. First thing Monday morning, I'm going to fire you. In fact, you're fired now."
Wright stood up unsteadily.
"Fired, you hear me?"
Cuthbert was standing at the front door of the laboratory, listening.
"What is it?"
Rickman asked in alarm. Cuthbert held his hand up sharply. Silence. At length, Cuthbert turned away from the door.
"I thought I heard a noise," he said.
He looked toward Rickman.
"Lavinia, could you come here a moment?"
"What is it?"
she asked, breathless. Cuthbert drew her aside.
"Hand me the torch," he said. "Now listen, I don't want to alarm you, but should something happen..."
"What do you mean?"
she interrupted, her voice breaking.
"Whatever it was that's been killing people is still loose. I'm not sure we're safe in here."
"But the door. Winston said it was 2 inches thick."
"I know. Maybe everything'll be fine, but those doors to the exhibition were even thicker than that, and I'd like to take a few precautions. Help me move this table up against the door."
He turned toward the director. Wright looked up vaguely.
"Fired. Clean out your desk by 5 o'clock Monday."
Cuthbert pulled Wright to his feet and sat him in a nearby chair. With Rickman's help, Cuthbert positioned the table in front of the oak door of the laboratory.
"That will slow it down anyway," he said, dusting off his jacket. "Enough for me to get in a few good shots with luck. At the first sign of trouble, I want you to go through that back door into the dinosaur hall and hide. With the security gates down, there's no other way into the hall. At least that will put 2 doors between you and whatever's out there."
Cuthbert looked around again restlessly.
"In the meantime, let's try to break this window. At least then maybe someone will be able to hear us yelling."
Wright laughed.
"You can't break the window. You can't. It's high-impact glass."
Cuthbert hunted around the lab, finally locating a short piece of angle iron. When he swung it vertically through the bars, it bounced off the glass and was knocked out of his hands.
"Bloody hell,"
he muttered, rubbing his palms together.
"We could shoot out the window," he speculated. "Do you have any more bullets hidden away?"
"I'm not talking to you anymore,"
Wright retorted. Cuthbert opened the filing cabinet and started fumbling in the dark.
"Nothing," he said at last. "We can't waste bullets on that window. I've only got 5 shots in here."
"Nothing, nothing, nothing. Didn't King Lear say that?"
Cuthbert sighed heavily and sat down. Silence filled the room once again, save only the wind and rain, and the distant roll of thunder. Pendergast lowered the radio and turned toward Margot.
"Augusta's in trouble. We've got to move fast."
"Leave me behind," said Frock quietly. "I'm just going to slow you down."
"A gallant gesture, but we need your brains."
He moved slowly out into the hall, sweeping his light in both directions. Then he signaled all clear. They moved down the hall, Margot pushing the wheelchair before her as quickly as possible.
As they threaded their way, Frock would occasionally whisper a few words of direction. Pendergast stopped at every intersection, gun drawn. Frequently, he halted to listen and smell the air. After a few minutes, he took the chair's handlebars from an unprotesting Margot. Then they rounded a corner, and the door of the secure area stood before them. For the 100th time, Margot prayed silently that her plan would work, that she wasn't simply condemning all of them, including the group trapped in the sub-basement, to a horrible death.
"Third on the right,"
Frock called as they moved inside the secure area.
"Margot, do you remember the combination?"
She dialed, pulled the lever, and the door swung open. Pendergast strode over and knelt beside the smaller crate.
"Wait."
Pendergast stopped, eyebrows raised quizzically.
"Don't let the smell of it get onto you. Bundle the fibers in your jacket."
Pendergast hesitated.
"Here, use my handkerchief to remove them."
Pendergast inspected it.
"Well, if the professor here can donate a $100 handkerchief, I suppose I can donate my jacket."
He took the radio and notebook, stuffed them into the waistband of his pants, then removed his suit jacket.
"Since when did FBI agents start wearing hand-tailored Armani suits?
Since when did graduate students in ethnopharmacology start appreciating them?"
Pendergast replied, spreading the jacket carefully on the floor. Then, gingerly, he scooped out several fistful of fiber and laid them carefully across his open jacket. Finally, he stuffed the handkerchief into one of the sleeves, folded the garment, and tied the sleeves together.
"We'll need a rope to drag it with."
"I see some packing cord around the far crate."
Pendergast tied the jacket and fashioned a harness, then dragged the bundle across the floor.
"Seems to be snug. Pity, though, that they haven't dusted these floors in a while."
He turned to Margot.
"Will this leave enough of a scent for the creature to follow?"
Frock nodded vigorously.
"The genetic extrapolator estimates the creature's sense of smell to be exponentially keener than ours. It was able to trace the crates to this vault, remember?"
"And you're sure the meals it's already had this evening won't satiate it?"
"Mr. Pendergast, the human hormone is a poor substitute. We believe the beast lives for this plant. If it smells an abundance of fibers, it will track them down."
"Let's get started, then,"
said Pendergast. He lifted the bundle gingerly.
"The alternate access to the sub-basement is several hundred yards from here. If you're right, we're at our most vulnerable from now on. The creature will home in on us."
Pushing the wheelchair, Margot followed the agent into the corridor. He shut the door, then the three moved quickly down the hall, back into the silence of the old basement. 53. The Gusta moved forward, crouching low in the water, his revolver nosing ahead into the inky darkness. He had turned off his flashlight to avoid betraying his position. The water flowed briskly between his thighs, its smell of algae and lime mixing with the fetid reek of the creature.
"Bailey, you up there?"
he whispered into the gloom.
"Yeah, I'm waiting at the first fork."
"You've got more rounds than I. If we drive off this motherfucker, I want you to stand guard while I go behind and try shooting off the lock."
"Roger."
DeGusta started toward Bailey, his legs numbing in the frigid water. Suddenly, there was a confusion of sounds in the blackness ahead of him. A soft splash, then another, much closer. Bailey's shotgun went off twice, and several people in the group behind him started whimpering.
"Jesus!"
he heard Bailey yell. Then there was a low, crunching noise, and Bailey screamed, and DeGusta fell thrashing in the water ahead of him.
"Bailey!"
he cried out, but all he could hear was the gurgle of running water. He pulled out his flashlight and shined it up the tunnel. Nothing.
"Bailey!"
Several people were crying behind him now, and somebody was screaming hysterically.
"Shut up! I have to listen!"
The screams were abruptly muffled. He played the light ahead, off the walls and ceiling, but he could see nothing.
Bailey had vanished, and the smell had receded once again. Maybe Bailey had hit the fucker. Or maybe it had just temporarily retreated from the noise of the shotgun. He shone the flashlight downward, and noticed the water flowing red around his legs. A torn shred of NYPD regulation blue cloth floated by.
"I need help up here,"
he hissed over his shoulder. Smithback was suddenly at his side.
"Point this flashlight down the passage,"
DeGusta told him. DeGusta probed the stone floor with his fingers. The water, he noticed, seemed to be a little higher. As he bent forward, reaching down, it grazed his chest. Something floated by beneath his nose, a piece of Bailey, and he had to turn away for a moment. There was no shotgun to be found.
"Smithback, I'm going back to shoot off the lock. We can't backtrack any farther with that thing waiting for us. Feel around in this water for a shotgun. If you see anything or smell anything, shout."
"You're leaving me here alone?"
Smithback asked a little unsteadily.
"You've got the flashlight. It'll just be for a minute. Can you do it?"
"I'll try."
DeGusta grasped Smithback's shoulder briefly, then started back. For a journalist, the guy had guts. A hand tugged at him as he waded through the group.
"Please, tell us what's happening,"
a feminine voice sobbed. He gently shook her off. DeGusta could hear the mayor talking soothingly to her. Maybe he'd vote for the old bastard next time.
"Everyone get back,"
he said, and positioned himself in front of the door. He knew he should stand well back from the door to avoid potential ricochets, but it was a thick lock, and he'd have a hard time aiming in the dark. He moved to within a few feet of the door, placed the barrel of the .38 near the lock, and fired. When the smoke cleared, he found a clean hole in the lock's center. The lock held fast.
"Fuck it."
He placed the muzzle of the revolver directly against the hasp and fired again. Now the lock was gone. He heaved his weight against the door.
"Give me a hand here."
Immediately, several people began throwing themselves against it. The rusty hinges gave way with a loud screech, and water gushed through the opening.
"Smithback, find anything?"
"I got his flashlight."
"Good boy, now come on back."
As DeGusta moved through the door, he noticed an iron D-ring on the other side as well. He stood back and ushered the group through, counting. 37. Bailey was gone. Smithback brought up the rear.
"All right, let's shut this thing,"
DeGusta yelled. Against the heavy flow of the water, the door groaned slowly shut.
"Smithback, shine one of the lights here. Maybe we can find a way to bar this door."
He looked at it for a second. If they could jam a piece of metal through the D-ring, it just might hold. He turned to the group.
"I need something, anything, made of metal. Does anyone have a piece of metal we can use to bar this door?"
The mayor passed quickly through the group, then came up to DeGusta, thrusting a small collection of metal items into his hands. As Smithback held the light, DeGusta inspected the pins, necklaces, combs.
"There's nothing here."
They heard a sudden splashing on the other side of the door, and a deep grunt. A stench filtered through the low slats in the door. A soft thump and a brief squeal of hinges, and the door was pushed ajar.
"Christ! You there, help me shut this door!"
As before, people flung themselves against the door, forcing it shut. There was a rattle and then a louder boom as the thing met their force, then pushed them back. The door creaked open farther. At DeGusta's shout, others joined the effort.
"Keep pushing!"
Another roar, then a tremendous thump heaved everyone back once again. The door groaned under the opposing weights, but continued to open, first 6 inches, then a foot. The stench became intolerable. Watching the door inch its way from the frame, DeGusta saw 3 long talons snake their way around the edge. The shape felt along the door, then swiped forward, the talons alternatingly sheathing and unsheathing.
"Jesus, Mary, and Joseph,"
DeGusta heard the mayor say quite matter-of-factly. Somebody else began chanting a prayer in a strange sing-song. DeGusta placed the barrel of the gun near the monstrosity and fired once. There was a terrible roar and the shape vanished into churning water. Smithback cried,
"The flashlight! It'll fit perfectly! Shove it into the ring!"
"That'll leave us with just one light."
"Got a better idea?"
"No. Everybody push!"
With a final heave, they slammed the door back into its iron frame, and Smithback shoved the flashlight through the D-ring. It slid through easily, its flared end coming to rest against the metal hasp. As DeGusta caught his breath, they heard another sudden crash, and the door shuddered, but held firm.
"Run, people! Run!"
They thrashed through the roiling water, falling and sliding. DeGusta, buffeted from behind, fell face first into the rushing water. He rose and continued forward, trying to ignore the monster's roaring and pounding. He did not think he could hear it and remain sane. He willed himself to think about the flashlight instead. It was a good, heavy, police-issue flashlight. It would hold. He hoped to God it would hold. The group stopped at the second fork in the tunnel, crying and shivering.
"Time to radio Pendergast and get the fuck out of this maze," DeGusta thought.
He clapped his hand to his radio holster, and with a shock realized it was empty. Coffee stood inside the forward security station, staring moodily at a monitor. He was unable to reach either Pendergast or DeGusta. Inside the perimeter, Garcia in security command and Waters in the computer room were still responding. Had everybody else been killed? When he thought of the mayor dead and the headlines that were sure to follow, a hollow feeling grew in his stomach. An acetylene torch, flickering near the silver expanse of the metal security door at the east end of the rotunda, cast ghostly shadows across the tall ceiling. The acrid smell of molten steel filled the air. The rotunda had grown strangely quiet. Field amputations were still taking place by the security door, but all the other guests had left for home or area hospitals. The journalists had finally been contained behind police barriers. Mobile intensive care units were set up on nearby side streets, and medics were standing by. The SWAT team commander came over, buckling an ammo belt over his black fatigues.
"We're ready," he said.
Coffee nodded.
"Give me a tactical."
The leader pushed a bank of emergency phones aside and unfolded a sheet.
"Our spotter will be leading us by radio. He's got the detailed diagrams from this station. Phase one. We're punching a hole through the roof here and dropping to the fifth floor. According to the specs of the security system, this door here will blow with one charge. That gives us access to the next cell. Then we proceed down to this prop storage room on the fourth floor. It's right above the Hall of the Heavens. There's a trap door in the floor that maintenance uses for cleaning and servicing the chandelier. We'll lower our men and haul the wounded up in sling chairs. Phase two, rescue those in the sub-basement, the mayor and the large group with him. Phase three, search for those who may be elsewhere within the perimeter. I understand that people are trapped in the computer room and security command. The museum director, Ian Cuthbert, and a woman as yet unidentified may have gone upstairs. And don't you have agents of your own within the perimeter, sir? The man from New Orleans field office?"
"Let me worry about him," Coffey snapped. "Who developed these plans?"
"We did, with the assistance of security command. That guy Allen has the cell layouts down cold. Anyway, according to the specs of this security system..."
"You did. And who's in charge here?"
"Sir, as you know, in emergency situations, the SWAT team, Commander..."
"I want you to go in there and kill the son of a bitch, got it?"
"Sir, our first priority is to rescue hostages and save lives. Only then can we deal with..."
"Calling me stupid, Commander? If we kill the thing in there, all our other problems are solved, right? This is not your typical situation, Commander, and it requires creative thinking."
"In a hostage situation, if you take away the killer's hostages, you've removed his base of power."
"Commander, were you asleep during our crisis control briefing? We may have an animal in there, not a person."
"But the wounded..."
"Use some of your men to get the damn wounded out, but I want the rest of you to go after what's in there and kill it. Then we rescue any stragglers at leisure, in safety and comfort. Those are your direct orders."
"I understand, sir. I would recommend, however..."
"Don't recommend jack shit, Commander. Go in the way you planned, but do the job right. Kill the motherfucker."
The commander looked curiously at Coffey.
"You sure about this thing being an animal?"
Coffey hesitated.
"Yes,"
he finally said.
I don't know a hell of a lot about it, but it's already killed several people.
The commander looked steadily at Coffee for a moment.
Yeah, he finally said. Well, whatever it is, we've got enough firepower to turn a herd of lions into a fine red mist. You're gonna need it. Find the thing. Take it out.
Pendergast and Margot looked down the narrow service tunnel into the sub-basement. Pendergast's flashlight sent a circle of light onto a sheet of black, oily water roiling past beneath them.
It's getting deeper,
Pendergast said. Then he turned to Margot.
Are you sure the creature can make it up this shaft?
I'm nearly certain. It's highly agile.
Pendergast stepped back and tried once again to raise DeGusta on the radio.
Something's happened. The lieutenant has been out of contact for 15 minutes, ever since they hit that locked door.
He glanced down again through the shaft that sloped toward the sub-basement below.
How are you planning to lay a scent with all this water?
You estimate they passed beneath here some time ago, right?
The last time I spoke to him, DeGusta told me the group was between the first and second forks. Assuming they haven't backtracked, he's well beyond this spot.
The way I see it, if we sprinkle some fibers on the water, the flow should carry them to the creature.
That's assuming the creature's smart enough to realize the fibers came floating from upstream. Otherwise, he might just chase them further downstream. I think it's smart enough. You mustn't think of this creature as an animal. It may be nearly as intelligent as a human being.
Using the handkerchief, Pendergast carefully removed some fibers from the bundle and sprinkled them along the base of the shaft. He dropped another handful into the water below.
Not too much,
Frock warned. Pendergast looked at Margot.
We'll sprinkle a few more fibers to establish a good upwater trail, then drag the bundle back to the secure area and wait. Your trap will be set.
After scattering a few more fibers, he secured the bundle.
At the rate this water is moving, it should only take a few minutes to reach the creature. How fast do you expect the thing to respond? If the extrapolation program is correct, the creature can move at a high rate of speed. Perhaps 30 miles an hour or greater, especially when in need. And its need for the fibers seems overpowering. It won't be able to travel at full speed down these corridors. The residual scent trail we leave will be harder to track, but I doubt the water will slow it down much. And the secure area is close by. I see. How unsettling. He that has a mind to fight, let him fight. For now is the time. Ah, Alcius,
said Frock, nodding. Pendergast shook his head.
Anacreon, Doctor. Shall we go?
54. Smithback held the light, but it hardly seemed to penetrate the palpable darkness. DeGusta, slightly in front, held the gun. The tunnel went on and on, black water rushing past and vanishing into the low-vaulted darkness. Either they were still descending, or the water was getting higher. Smithback could feel it pushing against his thighs. He glanced at DeGusta's face, shadowy and grim, his thick features smeared with Bailey's blood.
I can't go any farther,
someone wailed from the rear. Smithback could hear the mayor's familiar voice, a politician's voice, reassuring, soothing, telling everyone what they wanted to hear. Once again, it seemed to work. Smithback stole a glance backward at the dispirited group. The lean, gowned, bejeweled women, the middle-aged businessmen in their tuxedos, the smattering of yuppies from investment banks and downtown law firms. He knew them all now, had even given them names and occupations in his head. And here they all were, reduced to the lowest common denominator, wallowing around in the dark of a tunnel, covered with slime, pursued by a savage beast. Smithback was worried, but still rational. Early on, he'd felt a moment of sheer terror when he realized the rumors about a museum beast were true. But now, tired and wet, he was more afraid of dying before he wrote his book than he was of dying itself. He wondered if that meant he was brave, or covetous, or just plain stupid. Whatever the case, he knew that what was happening to him down here was going to be worth a fortune. Book party at Le Cirque, Good Morning America, The Today Show, Donahue, and Oprah. No one could do the story like he could. No one else had his first-person perspective. And he'd been a hero. He, William Smithback Jr., had held the light against the monster when DeGusta went back to shoot off the lock. He, Smithback, had thought of using the flashlight to brace the door. He'd been Lieutenant DeGusta's right-hand man.
"Shine the light up to the left there."
DeGusta intruded upon his thoughts, and Smithback dutifully complied. Nothing.
"I thought I saw something moving in the darkness. Must have been a shadow, I guess."
God, Smithback thought, if only he lived to enjoy his success.
"Is it just my imagination, or is the water getting deeper?" "It's getting deeper and faster. Pendergast didn't say which way to go from here."
"He didn't?"
Smithback felt his guts turn to water.
"I was supposed to radio from the second fork. I lost my radio somewhere back before the door."
Smithback felt another surge against his legs, a strong one. There was a shout and a splash.
"It's all right,"
the mayor called out when Smithback aimed the flashlight to the rear.
"Someone fell down. The current's getting stronger."
"We can't tell them we're lost,"
Smithback muttered to DeGusta. Margot swung open the door to the secure area, looked quickly inside, and nodded to Pendergast. The agent moved past the door, dragging the bundle. Frock said,
"Shut it in the vault with the Whittlesey crates. We want to keep the beast in here long enough for us to close the door on it."
Margot unlocked the vault as Pendergast threaded a complex pattern across the floor. They put the bundle inside, then closed and locked the ornate vault door.
"Quick, across the hall."
Leaving the main door to the secure area open, they crossed the hall to the elephant bone storage room. The small window in the door had long ago been broken, and a worn piece of cardboard now covered the opening. Margot unlocked the door with Frock's key, then Pendergast pushed Frock inside. Switching Pendergast's flashlight to its low setting, she balanced it on the elbow mechanism at the top of the door, pointing the thin beam in the direction of the secure area. Finally, with a pen, she reamed a small hole in the cardboard, and with a last look down the corridor, stepped inside. The storage room was large, stuffy, and full of elephant bones. Most of the skeletons were disassembled, and the great shadowy bones had been stacked on shelves like oversized cordwood. One mounted skeleton stood in a far corner, a dark cage of bones, two curving tusks gleaming in the pale light. Pendergast shut the door, then switched off his miner's lamp. Peering through the hole in the cardboard, Margot had a clear view of the hallway and the open door of the secure area.
"Take a look,"
she said to Pendergast, stepping away from the door. Pendergast moved forward.
"Excellent. It's a perfect blind, as long as those flashlight batteries hold out."
He stepped back from the door.
"How did you happen to remember this room?"
he asked curiously. Margot laughed shyly.
"When you took us down here on Wednesday, I remember seeing this door marked pachydermy and wondering how a person could fit an elephant skull through such a small door."
She moved forward.
"I'll keep watch through the peephole. Be ready to rush out and trap the creature in the secure area."
In the darkness behind them, Frock cleared his throat.
"Mr. Pendergast."
"Yes?"
"Forgive me for asking, but how experienced are you with that weapon?"
"As a matter of fact, before the death of my wife, I spent several weeks each winter big game hunting in East Africa. My wife was an avid hunter."
"Ah,"
Frock replied. Margot detected relief in his voice.
"This will be a difficult creature to kill, but I don't think it will be impossible. I was never much of a hunter, even when I had the use of my legs, but working together we may be able to bring it down."
Pendergast nodded.
"Unfortunately, this pistol puts me at a disadvantage. It's a powerful handgun, but nothing like a .375 Nitro Express rifle. If you could tell me where the creature might be most vulnerable, it would help.
From the printout, we can assume the creature is heavily boned. As you discovered, you won't kill it with a headshot. And an upper shoulder or chest shot toward the heart would almost certainly be deflected by the massive bones and heavy musculature of the creature's upper body. If you could catch the creature sideways, you might get a shot into the heart from behind the foreleg. But again, the ribs are probably built like a steel cage. Now that I think about it, I don't believe any of the vital parts of the beast are particularly vulnerable. A shot to the gut might kill eventually, but not before it took its revenge.
Cold comfort, Pendergast said. Frock moved restlessly in the darkness.
That leaves us in a bit of a quandary.
There was silence for a moment. There may still be a way, Pendergast said at length.
Yes?
Once, a few years ago, my wife and I were hunting bush buck in Tanzania. We preferred to hunt alone, without gun bearers, and the only guns we had were 30-30 rifles. We were in light cover near a river when we were charged by a Cape buffalo. It had apparently been wounded a few days earlier by a poacher. Cape buffalo are like mules. They never forget an injury, and one man with a gun looks much like any other.
Sitting in the dim light, waiting for the arrival of a nightmarish creature, listening to Pendergast narrate a hunting story in his typical unhurried manner, Margot felt a sense of unreality begin to creep over her.
Normally, in hunting buffalo, one tries for a headshot just below the horn bosses, or for a heart shot. In this case, the .30-30 was an insufficient caliber. My wife, who was a better shot than I, used the only tactic a hunter could use in such a situation. She knelt and fired at the animal in such a way as to break it down.
Break it down?
You don't attempt a kill shot. Instead, you work to stop forward locomotion. You aim for the forelegs, pasterns, knees. You basically shatter as many bones as you can until it can't move forward.
I see.
There is only one problem with this approach.
And that is?
You must be a consummate marksman. Placement is everything. You've got to remain serenely calm and steady, unbreathing, firing between heartbeats in the face of a charging beast. We each had time for four shots. I made the mistake of aiming for the chest and scored two direct hits before I realized the bullets were just burying themselves in muscle. Then I aimed for the legs. One shot missed and the other grazed but didn't break the bone. A poor performance, I'm afraid.
So what happened?
My wife scored direct hits on three out of her four shots. She shattered both front cannons and broke the upper foreleg as well. The buffalo tumbled head over heels and came to rest a few yards from where we were kneeling. It was still very much alive, but it couldn't move, so I paid the insurance, as a professional hunter would put it.
I wish your wife was here.
So do I.
Silence returned to the room.
Very well. I understand the problem. The beast has some unusual qualities that you should know about if you are planning to, break it down. First, the hindquarters are most likely covered in bony plates or scales. I doubt if you could penetrate them effectively with your gun. They armor the upper and lower leg down to the metatarsal bones, I'd estimate.
I see.
You will have to shoot low. Aim for the phalanx prima or secunda.
The lowest bones of the leg.
Yes, they would be equivalent to the pasterns on a horse. Aim just below the lower joint. In fact, the joint itself might be vulnerable.
That's a difficult shot. Virtually impossible if the creature is facing me.
There was a short silence. Margot continued her vigil through the peephole, but saw nothing.
I believe the anterior limbs of the creature are more vulnerable. The extrapolator described them as being less robust. The metacarpals and the carpals should both be vulnerable to a direct hit.
The front knee and the lower leg. The shots you've described already are hardly garden variety. To what extent would the creature have to be broken down to immobilize it?
Difficult to say. Both front legs and at least one rear leg, I'm afraid. Even then, it could crawl. Can you do it?
To have a chance, I'd need at least 150 feet of shooting space if the creature were charging. Ideally, I'd get the first shot in before the creature knew what was happening. That would slow it down.
Frock thought for a moment.
The museum contains several straight long corridors, 300 or 400 feet long. Unfortunately, most of them are not cut in half by these damn security doors. I believe that there's at least one unobstructed corridor within cell 2, however. On the first floor, in section 18, around the corner from the computer lab.
Pendergast nodded. I'll remember that, in case this plan fails.
I hear something.
They fell silent. Pendergast moved closer to the door.
A shadow just passed across the light at the end of the hall.
There was another long silence. Margot could hear a soft click as Pendergast slid back the safety on his gun.
It's here. I can see it. Oh, my God.
Pendergast murmured in Margot's ear.
Move away from that door.
She backed up, hardly daring to breathe.
What's it doing?
It stopped at the door to the secure area. It went in for a moment, and then backed out very fast. It's looking around, smelling the air. What does it look like?
Frock asked, an urgency in his voice. Pendergast hesitated a moment before answering.
I've got a better view of it this time. It's big. It's massive. Wait. It's turning this way. Good Lord. It's a horrible sight. It's flattened face, small red eyes, thin fur on the upper body, just like the figurine. Hold on. Hold on a minute. It's coming this way.
Margot suddenly realized she had moved back to the far wall. A snuffling sound came through the door, and then the rank, fetid smell. She slid to the floor in the heavy darkness, the peephole in the cardboard wavering like a star. Pendergast's flashlight shone feebly.
Starlight.
A small voice in Margot's head was trying to speak. And then a shadow fell over the peephole and everything went black. There was a soft, muffled thud against the door, and the old wood creaked. The doorknob rattled. There was a long silence. The sound of something heavy moving outside, and a sharp cracking as the creature pressed against the door. The voice inside Margot's head suddenly became audible.
Pendergast! Turn on your miner's lamp. Shine it at the beast!
What are you talking about?
It's nocturnal, remember? It probably hates light.
That's absolutely correct. Stay back,
Pendergast shouted. Margot heard a small click, then the brilliance of the miner's light blinded her momentarily. As her vision returned, she saw Pendergast on one knee, his gun leveled at the door, the bright circle of light focused directly on its center. There was another crunching noise, and Margot could see splinters spray into the room from a widening split in the upper panel. The door bowed inward. Pendergast stayed steady, sighting along the leveled barrel. There was another tremendous splintering sound, and the door broke inward in pieces, swinging crazily on bent hinges. Margot pressed herself against the wall, forcing herself into it until her spine creaked in protest. She heard Frock shout in amazement, wonder, and fear. The creature squatted in the doorway, a monstrous silhouette in the bright light. Then, with a sudden, throaty roar, it shook its head and backed out.
Keep back,
Pendergast said. He kicked the broken door aside and moved cautiously out into the hall. Margot heard a sudden shot, then another, then silence. After what seemed an eternity, Pendergast returned, motioning them forward. A trail of small red droplets led down the hallway and around the corner.
Blood? So you wounded it?
Frock said, bending forward with a grunt. Pendergast shrugged.
Perhaps, but I wasn't the first. The droplets originate from the direction of the sub-basement, see?
Lieutenant Augusta or one of his men must have wounded it earlier, but not disabled it. It moved away with amazing speed.
Marco looked at Frock. Why didn't it take the bait?
Frock returned her gaze.
We're dealing with a creature possessed of preternatural intelligence.
What you're saying is that it detected our trap, Pendergast said, a note of disbelief.